AI agents are everywhere, automating tasks and making decisions at machine speed. But agents make mistakes. Just one rogue agent can do big damage before you even notice. Rubrik Agent Cloud is the only platform that helps you monitor agents, set guardrails, and rewind mistakes, so you can unleash agents, not risk. Accelerate your AI transformation at rubrik.com. That's rubrik.com.
There's nothing like being in the stands cheering on your favorite team. GameTime is your hack to unlocking amazing tickets in just a few taps. Plus, their GameTime guarantee means you can trust you'll get 100% authentic tickets at the best price. Fees are always included, so what you see is what you pay. Get the best deals on sports tickets. Download the GameTime app and create an account to start searching for tickets to upcoming games and events. Swipe, tap, ticket, go. GameTime.
Welcome to the Domestic Abuse Breakthrough Show, where we tackle violence against women and girls through education, empowerment, and hope. Join Kate, a survivor and advocate, as she shares insights, strategies, and stories that inspire healing and action. Together, we'll break the cycle and pave the way for a future of safety and strength. This show contains a trigger warning. And now, here's your host, Kate Beasley.
So welcome back to another episode, and today I am joined by Wes Owen Cunliffe. Welcome, Wes.
Thank you for having me.
It's great to have you. Do you want to just tell the listeners about what you do, and how you got into all this?
It's a bit of a confusing story, really. I currently working with CalAmm DVS Domestic Violence Service. I'm working with young people and young men who are victims of domestic abuse currently. But also in my spare time, I also advocate and do workshops. And I send messages to young people across the country about get involved in knife crime, get involved in crime in general as a whole. And I talk to them about the risk and consequences of that, and tell them and explain to young people where that life will lead you, exactly how that led me down that route. So I'm a youth mentor by trade, and so I work with young people from the age of 11 all the way up to 25 in that arena. When I work in domestic violence, I can work with anybody up to the age of 50 on that. So I work with men and women across the board. Boys and girls, and from all different kinds of backgrounds, and I just relate to them because I've walked down the path. A lot of them have, and I've also grew up in an environment where a lot of young people also are currently growing up in, unfortunately.
I mean, obviously, I know a little bit about your background and where that sort of led. Do you want to just share a little bit about that?
Yeah, I grew up in Newport. A small working town in Wales. It's now a city. Now we've hosted the Ryder Cup from the Celtic Manor, so we've become a city for that reason. But I've always grown. When I grew up, it was a town, working class town. I was living with my mother and my two younger siblings, single parent household. My grandfather, my mother's father, was my father figure in my life. And my mother had issues with alcohol and her mental health, so she had her own demons to battle. And we were living in poverty. Things wasn't great at that point. Not very good clothes, not much food. The rent was always being owed, potentially being evicted. At one point, we did get evicted from like five or six houses. We must have moved at least half a dozen times in our lifetime, so nowhere stable. And that led me down a path then of getting involved in crime, in drug dealing. And I was 11 when I first got involved in that life. And I was doing that for a number of years until I was 16, when it completely went wrong. I got stabbed. Now, before I get to that bit, it's really important. I always speak to young people that the upbringing that I was up, I don't blame that at all, but I did grow up around violence a lot. My mother did choose distasteful men. I was fighting men by the time I was 12, 13. They would you know, be very aggressive and violent towards my mother. I would try and defend my mother, and obviously as a result of that, I'd also get a beating as well. And what I used to do there is basically I took the beating because, in my mind, as long as my mother and my brothers didn't get the beating, it's all right for me to have it. So it sounds a bit confusing to some people, but in that situation, that's how I perceived it at 12, 13. I just thought if I took all the anger, that means my mother and my brothers won't receive the anger. So it's also a bit of like a protective factor. Clearly, that's not the way forward to do it. But that's what I did, you know, which led me down that path. And then when I got involved in the violence, growing up as well, and that's when I got stabbed. Going to A&E, ended up nearly losing my life. Police officers saved my life at the scene by putting socks and bandages in my thigh and in my stomach. And I got charged with possession of intent to supply, Class A drugs. And when I got sent to young offenders, when I come out 18 months later, I served my time on remand. A judge gave me a second chance at life. And I completely started walking away from that life, really. Ended up finding rugby, which I didn't think I'd do, even though I'm Welsh. And it's in my grandparents' blood to like rugby, even though it's not going well for us right now with the Six Nations, however. In Wales, in front of the valleys, particularly, rugby's part of the culture, so to speak. So, I took up rugby. I was playing, you know, average level, enjoying it, made new friends, new surroundings, and then I got approached then to play semi-professional rugby for Ebervale. Yeah. And that completely turned everything around completely even more then. I walked away from that life, playing professional rugby, so to speak, semi-professional rugby, a whole new friendship group again. Absolutely crazy. I can't explain really what that actually, I can't explain it to you. It was just complete 360 turnaround. A turnaround I never thought I'd do, but I did. And that led me down the path of supporting people. Now, how I got down that path is very, it's not your conventional one.
So just on the topic of you going into drug dealing, what do you think led you into down that path? Was it the money aspect and the struggling financially with your mom and everything?
Yeah, it was mainly money. And I say this to young people, I don't glamorise it at all. There's nothing glamorous about drug dealing. There's nothing glamorous about getting involved in life of crime. There's nothing glamorous about getting involved in gang culture. And I'm completely honest, I didn't do it to get a reputation. I didn't do it to get higher up the ladder. I didn't do it to get a name for myself. I generally did do it at the time. Because that's at that time, at that age, that's the only way I could earn money. Legally, I'm not allowed to work. I could get a paper in, what's that going to pay for? So being realistic, that was the only way forward to earn money, really. And that's what I was doing. It's really for financial. And I say financial gain, not to be rich like a millionaire. It was solely to keep the heating on, to keep the electric on, and to feed my little brothers. That's the reason I did it.
So that was you again taking on that protector role. The easiest way that you knew how to resolve that problem, essentially.
Yeah, I can't deny it. I knew what I was doing was wrong. And I know a lot of people who will listen to this will say that's very controversial. But when, like I said, when you're 13 and you're quite poor and, you know, the electric bill runs out often and the gas bill runs out often and your brothers need food, your brothers need clothes, I had to take control of that. That was my way of doing it.
And, you know, I mean, we've obviously, before we started recording, and obviously when we spoke, so last week, we've spoken a lot about being trauma-informed, and that is me viewing that through a trauma-informed lens. You did it purely as, rightfully or wrongly, you did it purely as a means of doing what you felt was best for your family, as because you took on that protector role.
Yeah, and
that's what obviously professionals need to understand when they are approaching these young people. It's like, well, you know, what's influencing their behaviour? You know, why? What's behind it? And the idea is to intervene early so that things don't escalate, which is obviously what you where you come in isn't it now? And you try and avoid those escalation points in behaviours.
Yeah, when I work with young people, there's two things I call it, two target words. I call it the push and pull. So either way you look at it, what pushes a young person into that kind of life, or what does pull a young person in that kind of life? Both got the same agenda, but comes in a different way. And when I say pulls you into it, that's what I would say words explain me. That's what would probably cover me. What pulled me into that life?
Yeah.
Poverty, my environment. You know, when you're growing up in domestic violence, when you're growing up in that kind of household, when you're growing up in that, you kind of just do your best to say, do you know what, I need to take control here. Clearly at 13, I don't know what I'm doing. But at that point in my mind, I just felt that was the right way forward. That pulled me into that. What pushes young people into it, though, is a different scenario again. What pushes young people is when you look at social media today, like the glamorizing of that lifestyle. You see movies, you see music videos, you see social media posts, you see all these kind of things for young boys and girls. A lot of people think it's just boys, girls as well. What pushes a young person from both genders into that? And when I talk to young people, I can see where their journey's going in before they realize it's getting there. And that's where I come in then to intervene before it escalates into that world, whether that's a young person getting involved in drug dealing and carrying a knife, I also, or being a receiving end or being a victim of a knife attack, I actually come at that point and say to the young people, do you know where this ends up? Do you know where you're going if you do this? There is an option. There is another road you can take, but you need to be honest and open up about that. And that's where I felt I went wrong myself at that point as a young person. But opening up as I got older really helped me make those right decisions, because I'm not going to deny it. I've always said this. Even when I got signed for Ebervale, playing semi professional rugby, I was still hanging on the fence whether to go back into that life or not, you know, because that's all I knew. That's all I knew. And I've always said, with young people, the fear of the unknown is so overwhelming, because that is something, and it sounds crazy, but when you're dealing, you can control certain things. But when you actually go straight and you go into positive things, like I said, when I went professional rugby, there's a lot of things that's out of my control. I might not get picked now to play every Saturday. Yeah. I might get injured. I now no longer be able to earn money from rugby if I do get injured. So there's a lot of things that's now out of my control. And that's a very scary thing, because and when I say control, as a man, those two words normally don't go well together. But when I say control from my perspective, as in I can no longer control what my outcomes are going to look like. So, and I know that's a very fear of anxiety, and the weight of anxiety is weighing them down with that, the young people that I'm supporting. Yeah. And you can see that is weighing them down.
Yeah.
And I come in to support them to try and relieve that weight and say, there is a way out of this life for you. There is a way forward for you. You don't have to go down this road.
It's not just young people, though. This is people in general. The unknown, uncertainty, represents greater danger to the brain than anything at all. That's why one of the many reasons why a victim stays so long with a perpetrator is the fear of the unknown. Because sometimes the fear of the unknown, okay, well, what if I can't afford to keep food on the put food on the table, keep a roof over the head? What if I never find somebody to love me ever again? What if I'm always going to be alone? All these what ifs consume you. And that represents to the brain more danger than actually staying in something that is physically and really dangerous and could take your life. And that is it. So it's the same whether we're talking about young people or we're talking about anybody. It is the unknown that is the biggest fear for people.
Yeah, and I always try and encourage young people and adults, whoever I'm supporting, I always try and encourage them to not be afraid of the unknown, because when I look back right now, it was actually one of the best things. Now, it's a different scenario, but it's the same principle. When I first signed up with Vale, my whole environment was different, completely different. And when I say environment, as in I was with my grandparents. So I was getting breakfast, dinner, tea. I was being told to go to bed at a certain time. Don't get me wrong, my grandparents are old school. So I was more or less raised old school. You know, you always say please, you always say thank you. You always help the elderly. If you don't help the elderly, I would get a real telling off or a real come down off my grandparents for not doing that. And if I have children, I've got to be a man and pay for my children. You know, that was the old school way, the old school rules. But when I say that, it did come with love and care from my grandparents, which is very unknown. And then what was also unknown, which was scary, my very first season up in Ebervale, and a lot of people always say, why do you talk about that so much? I played for Newport and I played for Cross Keys. And both clubs as well are very, very amazing clubs with a lot of rugby history. But what changed for me in Ebervale was, and it also happened to me at Newport, I had support. My first season up in Ebervale, I had support as Player of the Year. So what that means is I became a favourite of the people that watch, of working class people as well who watch. And also, I've been told there was young kids that wanted to buy jerseys with my number on the back. They all wanted to be like Wes. So, and that was very unknown to me because only a year or so ago, I'd been classed as scum of society. I'd been classed as somebody who's a hindrance, somebody who's a blight, somebody who has no positive effect on the community and literally a complete 360 turnaround.
Yeah.
I've got now young people who look up to me. I've had phone calls off my coach saying, Wes, the under-11s want to come and deliver the presentation. They want the under-10s, the under-12s. And I'm like, what is going on here? Like, it's completely unknown to me. And the emotional side of it was completely alien to me. I didn't know how to handle those emotions. I'm being completely honest with you. I didn't know what to do. Didn't know what to do.
Yeah, and that's why it did turn your life around, because you've gone from being invisible. And when you're not invisible, you're seen as this, you know, a nuisance and inconvenience, to suddenly getting the recognition that you craved for all your life, really.
I didn't get recognition. I generally didn't. For me, it was literally just to completely turn my life around and no longer be involved in that world of crime and violence. I just didn't. Just didn't want it no more, you know.
No, intelligently you won't have, but on a nervous system level, it's like, well, those wounds are not exposed anymore. Suddenly, you know, these wounds are. I'm important. I'm worthy of. You know, people are seeing me. So those wounds are being soothed, and that's why. But then there would still have been. That's when you said I was still a little bit on the fence because of the unknown. It was like, well, this is alien to me. This, I don't know what comes with this. This is like, oh my God, this could like turn into real danger, this. Okay, but we know what comes with that over there. Yes. And you literally, that's why you were on the fence. You were like, uh-oh, right, okay. Well, my wounds have been soothed, but actually, am I going to get a shock of my life just suddenly out of nowhere, and that's going to represent more danger where I'm not in control? Well, I know what comes with that. And that's why you were on the fence.
Yeah, and it goes back to that bit where on the fence for me was going back to what I knew, back to what I know, I'm with, because I'm, that's what I knew.
Like certainty, familiarity.
Yeah, like these supporters took me in. They knew about my background. They didn't care about my background. And it's not. This is not really a big thing to me. It never has been, but when I look back on it as well, when I was up there, these are young kids, 11, 12, 13, who are kind of now looking at me as a role model to a degree. And these kids are white. I'm a brown mixed race lad, you know, and I've got young white kids who are seeing me as a role model, which is, yet again, completely alien to me, being a role model, you know. After a game, the kids would just follow me around, talk to me, ask me about the game. Can I come up to them? Can I come and watch them play on a Sunday? They'd love to see me watch them play on a Sunday. I would go and do that, and they'd be over the moon. I got parents saying, can you come to, you know, the birthday parties? Can you come and present presentation night. It's a complete unknown surrounding. Now, to a person who's a athlete or somebody who does that on a daily basis, they've done that from a very long time. That wasn't the first 20 years of my life. That wasn't what it was. It was always negative. You're never going to go that far. You'll never go down this path. It's always going to be this. And here I am, completely gone against what people predicted. Yeah. And that was completely unknown. I'm not going to lie. It was completely unknown. I didn't know how to deal with it. I generally didn't know how to deal with it until I met my lovely partner, Rhiannon. That's when a lot of things got for the better again, really.
Yeah. Well, we're just going to break for a short interval and we'll continue this conversation when we get back.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
There's nothing like being in the stands cheering on your favorite team. Game Time is your hack to unlocking amazing tickets in just a few taps. Plus, their Game Time guarantee means you can trust you'll get 100% authentic tickets at the best price. Fees are always included, so what you see is what you pay. Get the best deals on sports tickets. Download the Game Time app and create an account to start searching for tickets to upcoming games and events. Swipe, tap, ticket, go. Game Time.
The station that makes you feel good.
So welcome back. Now, Wes is just obviously, we've been talking on the break. He is part of speaking up with Derbyshire Police, isn't it?
Yeah.
Which is all about more men speaking out about male violence towards women, girls and children. Do you want to tell us a little bit more about that? Because obviously, you know, this is something that's, and it's true. We do need more men like you that are speaking out because it gets a little bit, it's difficult for us and just our voice, on our own. We do need men to speak up as well, because obviously this fight is against a certain group of men that want to dominate and control, and unfortunately, it results in lives being lost. You know, so it does need men to call men out. Because they don't like it from us.
Yeah, I don't know why that is. Like I said, when I grew up in my mother's environment, what I saw a relationship between a man and a woman was completely different to what I saw in a relationship between my grandparents.
Yeah.
I saw my granddad, in my opinion, treat my nan very, very nice. You know, of course, they had their rows. Nobody's perfect. But when I see how those two behaved, I generally thought, yeah, that's how a man should treat their wife or their girlfriend or their husband or, you know, their wife or her wife, whichever kind of relationship that looks like. I just felt that's how you, you know, treat your partner, you know, your wife, the so-called love of your life scenario. And when I went straight, and let me talk about the rugby, in that period where I started going straight and I was on the fence, I got a job as a bouncer. I struggled getting a job at first because of my past. And when I got a bouncer in Newport, that really was my first taste of like proper employment and working regularly. And I encountered a lot of things while I was on the door. And unfortunately, I had a lot of good, but unfortunately, there was also a lot of bad. And a lot of the bad was the amount of violence against women and the amount of attacks on women that I saw as a man, and I found that very distasteful.
Yeah.
As a man, I generally do find it distasteful. And I've seen men putting their hand up women's skirts quite abruptly. I've even had some women walking out to tell me, and they're kind of like, as in limping, because it's being that forceful. And I've always asked the women that, you know, do they need medical attention? You know, at that time, they used to have the ambulances on standby in the town, you know, and to answer any emergency calls. And I would always ask during the call the, you know, first aid or medical professional over to check you out. And they'd be like, no. But I'd always eject those men from the nightclub straight away. When they questioned me, like, why did you throw me out? I didn't do nothing wrong. I was like, absolutely, you did do something wrong. And he's like, what have I done wrong? I was like, you don't put your hands up women's skirts like that, bud. You don't do that. That's not gentlemanlike. It's very distasteful. You don't treat people like that. You don't, mate. That's not how it works in my world anyway. You don't do that.
Yeah.
And he wasn't happy about it, but he was quite shocked that another man called him out about his behaviour. And I'm not saying Hercules by long shot, but I kind of got a bit of a name as a bouncer where a lot of women would now start coming to me and tell me about things that men are doing to them. Cause I think they knew how I would react to that, in all fairness. And I also, by accident, also caught once. I was inside, and I just looked, just to check. And I just looked in the one corner, and I saw a gentleman talking to a girl. And I saw him rub his fingers together over the girl's drink, and I saw the dust come out of his hand into the drink. Now, I'm sure it was probably Rohypnol. I could be wrong, but it was definitely a drug of some kind. Yeah. And I walked up to him. I threw him out, and I said to the girl, do not touch that drink. Get yourself another one. And I'm not sure if you remember, when I worked as a bouncer, it was that era, if you remember, when nightclubs could start getting those dip tests where you can tell if your drink has been spiked or not. Like, remember those?
I don't remember them.
You can get things in the pubs, you know, where beyond the bar, you can get a little dip test, dip them in the drink to make sure it's still clean. And we dipped it in, and it went a different colour. And he was like, yeah, this has definitely been spiked with something.
Right.
She was like, oh my God, thank you so much. And I was like, well, imagine if we didn't spot that, what could have happened?
Yeah.
To that young girl. I think it's about 20, 21, 22. But I thought, what could have happened to that young girl if we hadn't clocked that, you know? Like, and what was his intentions anyway? Like, you know, putting that drug in that girl's drink. Clearly we know what his intentions were. It wasn't to have a good time. Well, not for her anyway.
Well, no, it's for him to have a good time and for her to forget it.
Yeah, and I find that absolutely horrendous behaviour. I do, absolutely horrendous.
Yes, it's disgusting. Well, it's rape.
Yeah, absolutely. And I didn't realise that, but people tell me you prevented possibly a rape from happening.
Yeah.
And I was like, okay. And then what really turned it around was, I can remember it plain as day. It was Boxing Day, and I was on the door. And back then it was packed, like Newport would be packed. And I was on the door and letting people in, you know, clicking people in, clicking people out. It wasn't a very big club, so, you know, we can only hold a couple of hundred tops in this club. So within an hour, we get packed pretty quickly, and then there's a queue. And there's a couple coming up next in the queue, and I just looked at her, and I could see the look on her face, and she must have been about 24, 25, and the look on her face was fear. I could see her on her face, and he grabbed her by the arm and whispered in her ear, but quite abruptly, you know, you kind of see, it was a bit like, don't you be misbehave tonight, or you're going to, you know, it was something like that. You can tell it was something threatening to her. So I just thought on the hop. I went, that didn't sit with me. And I just said, I don't know why I said it. I just said, excuse me. I said, we're doing random bag searches. Can I search your bag? And she was like, oh, okay. I said, step aside, please, my lovely. And I said to the gentleman, I said, go on in. She'll be with you in a minute. And he went, oh, okay. And I was searching through her bag, and she went, see, there's nothing in there. But when I looked at her, I could see a bit of swelling, and you could see the makeup trying to cover the bruise on under, I remember putting say under her left eye. And she looked at me, and I looked at her, and I stopped rummaging through her bag. And I said, I wasn't looking in your bag for drugs. She said, oh, what'd you pull me for? I said, are you okay? She said, what do you mean? I said, you didn't look happy there. Are you all right? And I said, your eye tells me a different story. Like, are you all right? And then she looked at me for a minute. I said, look, you haven't got to tell me anything, but I am here to listen. You know, are you okay? You know, I said, I can help you. If you need help, I'm here. And she just broke down crying. And she just said, he beat me up earlier. That's where I got the eye. Because she said, actually, I didn't want to go out tonight. She said, because I had a lot to drink on Christmas Day. She didn't feel up to going out on Boxing Day, but he forced her to do it. And she said, he gave her a couple of backhander slaps, you know, across the face. And like, we're going out tonight, whether you like it or not. And that's why She was there. I said, okay, what do you want to do now? She went, I don't want to see him anymore. She said, I can't take it. So I said, right, okay. So I walked her through the club with me to the back in the office. And before people get the wrong idea, I did ask for a female member of staff beyond the bar to come in with me. And her partner said, what's going on? I said, well, I found some substances in a bag. I need to check them, sir. And he's like, no, that's a lie. There's no drugs on her. I said, well, that's your opinion. But I said, I'm legally obliged now to do this. I said, so she has got a substance. I need to make sure she hasn't. That's a legal drug, if it's a class A drug. Mm-hmm. And he's like, oh, so I took her in the office. I said, right, you wait here while I go and get my colleague. So I got my other colleague in. I said, listen, this lady has been injured by this gentleman this afternoon and tonight. She is scared and she doesn't want to see him anymore. So I said, can you keep him here and talk to him? And I said to the lady who sat with me, I said, member of staff, I said, can you sit with her, please? And I ran out of the club. And I ran literally only 30 yards around the corner to call two police officers. And two officers came up, two female officers. They came up and they said, look, I've got a young lady in my club here. She's just disclosed to me that her partner has beat her up this afternoon and forced her to come out. She doesn't want to come out. I said, she's currently in the club right now. She doesn't want to speak to him. She will cooperate with the police. I asked her permission to speak to you. She said yes. And I said, look, I think you need to speak with her. Then fair play to the police. They got on the radio to have another backup. I think it was to deal with him and then the other two officers to deal with the lady. And that was it. That was the last I saw of her at that point. And then a week later, while I was working, the police came and saw me and said, look, they have my contact details. They want me to come and see me. They want me to possibly testify, a court because she is pressing charges. And I said, yeah, fine, okay. I don't mind. And what happened after that? I went to court and I was only there for an hour. A few months later, there for an hour, I testified only what she said to me about what happened that evening. And she also did say to me, this is not the first time that she's had a slap. That was her exact words. That wasn't the first time she had a slap. And I just asked her, I said, how many more times? And she said, oh, over the last couple of years now. I was like, okay, friend, there's been so many. I can't tell you exactly the last one completely. And I was like, okay. And that was my testimony. As far as I'm aware, I think he got a sentence, I believe. And I saw her a couple of years later and she's got a husband now and two lovely children. I think she lives out in the country way somewhere, like a farm type area in Wales. And she just said, thank you so much. And her husband shook my hands and she saw me in a pub. I was out with my family, with my grandparents, just having a bit of food and a beer. And someone just tapped me on the shoulder and I turned around. It was her and her parents were there as well, and her current husband was there, and she just hugged me really and gave me a kiss, and she just said, like, there's not many men like you, and I'd like to thank you so much. And I didn't know what I'd really take that really. I just thought I was just doing my job, but then I was just like, okay, that's happened. And my granddad just sat me down and he just said, I think you found your calling, kiddo. I said, what do you mean, Dad? And he went, well, I think clearly you are designed to work with people here. Mm-hmm. So I was like, what do you mean? He went, well, work with, help people. I don't know. He said, work in school with kids, or he said, sports coaching, or he said, work in a halfway house. He said, whatever. He said, I think working with people, he said, I think that's what you need to do. And that was my first taste into it, really. And that's what led me into supporting people, really, my interaction with that lady that night.
Yeah. Yeah, and that is it, and that's something I encourage people all the time, is because for us to heal, move on from our past, we have to find meaning. We seek closure all the time, but the only way we're going to seek closure is to find meaning from what we went through, and the only way that we find meaning is to carve out that meaning for ourselves. Nobody's going to hand us an explanation, some reason as to why you've been subjected to all the horrific things you've gone through in your life. It's something we have to carve out ourselves. And that is obviously something that you did, by accident, really, didn't you?
It was. It's just the way she looked, you know, when I saw the queue. It's as a human being, it just didn't sit with me. You know, the way she was looking, it just didn't sit with me. I don't know what it was. I just come out with the tale of I need to search your bag randomly. Yeah. You know, just to get the speech for one, you know. I don't know what it was. It just didn't sit with me, the way she was looking, and she did look sad and she did look scared as well. And yeah, it just wasn't very nice to see.
Yeah.
And the reason I call it out is I've got a daughter. She is 14 years old now.
Mm.
And at some point, whether that's now or when she's 18, 25, at some point she's going to meet a person. You know, whether that's a boy or a girl, doesn't matter. It doesn't bother me. I love her no matter what. But at some point she's going to meet somebody. And I always ask myself, as a father, and I hope other fathers listen to this, or uncles, or brothers, you know, who've got female siblings or nieces and nephews and aunties and things like that. I always ask the question, like, what would you do if your daughter come back and told you that? Like, what would you feel if that was your daughter? I'm not going to lie. I'm not a violent person, far from it. But if my daughter ever come back to me when she's 18, 19, 20, even 48, if she come back to me and she had that kind of mark on her eye and she told me what happened, And I'm not inciting violence, but I'm telling you now, it wouldn't end very well for that boy. I can promise you that it wouldn't end very well for him. I don't mean inciting violence, but as a father here, picture that being your daughter.
Exactly.
Picture that being your sister. In some cases, picture that being your mother. That's somebody's mother. That's somebody's daughter. That's somebody's sister. That's somebody's auntie. That's somebody's cousin. That lady is somebody special to someone. You've always got to ask yourself that question. Like, as a father, what would you do if you got told that's what happened to your daughter? Whether that's wolf whistling, hand up the skirt, assaulted, what would you do if you got told that as a dad? And I think a lot of men need to think about that, really. What would you do if that was your own daughter?
Yeah, 100%. So we're just going to break for another interval, and we'll see you after the break.
The station that makes you feel good. UK Health Radio. The station that makes you feel good.
So welcome back. So, where's the importance of turning a pain into a positive? This is everything that this is a big message that I obviously try to deliver on pretty much as many shows as I possibly can, to be honest with you.
Yeah.
Because it's essential for moving forward. It's essential for healing. And I know this is something that you do as well with the young people that you support, because that's in a nutshell what you've done also. How do you model that to these young people?
It's a very good question. I do it more or less as a practical, physical thing, very tangible. Like I'm here. Look, I've turned it around. So can you? You can find a way out of this. A lot of young people I work with grew up in an environment very similar to what I grew up in. So I generally understand at that point what their view of the world is and how easy it is to view the world as against you. I know it's easy. And I've always said to young people, and I always live by this, it's easier to hate than love yourself. It's a lot more easier to do that, to hate yourself. Loving yourself is very hard to do, especially when you've got an environment where that's not normal, with encouragement and support and, you know, things that you need to help you move along in life and guidance. So I do that by giving that to young people, really, giving them that kind of model, not a role model, but give them a target, like actually somebody who's come from where you've come from, somebody who's grown up how you've grown up, and here I am telling you, you can turn it around. And that's what I meant by a physical, practical thing. It's there, it's tangible. I don't believe in where do you see yourself in 5 years, because some people I support, sometimes it's hour by hour, day by day with some of the young people I support. So asking them where they see themselves in 5 years, it's completely not the right question to ask. What the right question to ask is, where do you see yourself tomorrow? Because I think that's more tangible.
Yeah.
A young person by getting to that goal. Small goals, small steps. The smallest make the biggest difference for you. And that's the thing, like I said, when I went to play rugby for the Vale, put out to support me. For me, it was a big thing. But to a supporter then come to watch, it was a very small thing to them, because that's rugby's part of their culture. That's what they do. That's their identity. That's what it looks like. And slowly they were chipping away at me to make that part of my identity as well. In terms of rugby, Wales, be proud of that. Be proud of being Welsh. Be proud of the heritage. Be proud of the language. Be proud of it. Same thing here. Be proud of your past. And when I say be proud of your past, I'm not proud in terms of what I've done in terms of crime, but what I am proud of is that I'm glad I've gone through that road, because now I can tell other people personally it doesn't end well, whether that's drug dealing or pick up a knife. I can tell you personally it doesn't end well. I'm proud that I can actually do that now.
Yeah, 100%. I mean, what I would always say to people as well is you know, what do you want for your life? What do you want for your life? And then, you know, get that image in your mind and then genuinely ask yourself, is this current path going to get you to that goal? And if it's not, well, how can we make changes?
Yeah.
And these aren't big, massive leap changes. These are baby step changes.
Yeah. Like
I said, day by day. These are day by day changes.
Yeah.
And, you know, it will feel like at first that you're actually making no progress at all. But then when
it will feel like that, yeah.
Yeah, when you get 12 months down the line, you start to think, yeah, see, I'm still not where I want to be. But let's look how far you've come. You've come so far, and that's what people have to do, whether, you know, young people, whether it's anybody. It's a case of, you know, making baby steps, not to putting too much pressure on ourselves, because if we do, we're going to set ourselves up for failure, and that's not going to help ours in moving forward.
And that's why I say it's easier to hate yourself than love yourself. It is 100%. Easier to do that. Mm-hmm. And I mean that in society as well. It's always easier to hate somebody than love somebody. You'll always find the bad rather than the good. Everybody always remembers the first, never the second, third, or the fourth.
Yeah.
Everybody always sees the bad. Regardless that you come from a very chaotic lifestyle, you overcome adversity, you get yourself to the Olympic final, but you only come third. Forget the journey you've made to get to that point.
Yeah.
You only come third. So that's why I say it's easier to hate somebody than love somebody.
100%.
And that's why I believe in day by day, even hour by hour, completely depends on the young people and adults that I support. It was the same thing with me, day by day, week by week.
Yeah.
And like I said, at the end of that year of 2010, when I got awarded Supporter Player of the Year, did not see that come in. Did not see that come in. When I play for Newport, you know, Newport mascots, Player of the Year, that means in Newport rugby, like the young people that come and support Newport, like, who is your favourite Player of the Year? And it was me. And I was like, I didn't see that coming either. And it does, like, how far you've come to that. Like, at one point, I was more or less being groomed, and also to a degree grooming young people myself to get involved in the world of crime to make more money. And then here I am being a role model in the end to young people and other people, which I completely can't believe has happened. It's completely on a 360, but like I said, it was easier to hate myself than like myself.
Yeah.
It was not easy to do that, and to like yourself takes a lot of energy, takes a lot of time. It does take a lot out of you to like yourself. But I can promise you, it's far worth it in the end. And for me, it's not about earning loads of money. When I go to work, sometimes I come home and my kids go, "Daddy, you're back." There's no price on that.
Yeah.
There's no price in a million years on that. When your partner says, "I'm proud of you for what you're doing. You're the best dad in the world." So mostly, I'm the best partner in the world. Mostly. Sometimes I'm not. Mostly, your best partner in the world. You're the best dad in the world. You can't put a price on that. You know, there's nothing in the world that puts a price. And it's not about being famous. It's not about getting fame on social media, getting fame on anything. It's £1 million is worth when my son says, "Daddy, you're back. Daddy, you're home." That's that means a million more to me than when I sat in that cell and when I'm looking over my shoulder, if anybody's going to attack me, when you're in that life of crime, when you are the perpetrator sometimes, when you're wondering, my God, is the law going to be really affectionate on me, or is the law really going to take us, really going to go against me? When you hear just that little sentence, "Daddy, you're back," honestly, that is worth more than any money.
Yeah,
worth more than any money in the world. Just hearing that sentence, "Daddy, you're back,"
and that is it. It is literally about making enough money to be able to create the memories with the people who mean the most to us in life, and that is the most important thing. It's not about, you know, having a massive house, driving the best car. All those things are really nice, but ultimately, it's about creating memories with the people that we love.
Absolutely, and I send this message home to the young people a lot as well, because we look at crime, especially drug dealing, the glamorization of things on social media and movies, like you can actually live this life. I've always said you can buy a house, but not a home.
Yeah.
You can be rich, but you can have health insurance, but you cannot buy health.
No.
You know what I mean? And I learned that lesson with my granddad, you know. I felt, you know, he didn't deserve to die, but, you know, if he had a bit of money, that wouldn't have made any difference to him. In the end, he had prostate cancer. He had that for a long time. But when he turned in his 80s and his body started rejecting the treatment, it went to his lymph gland and it went everywhere in his body. And you can see, you know, he was half the man that he once was. But at the same time, the doctor said to him, you know, "You haven't got long left to live, Owen." And I sat there then and thinking, we could have had £1 million in the bank. That would have made not one bit of difference to the outcome of my granddad's health.
Yeah.
And he didn't smoke either. You know, he's quite a healthy man. And we could have had all that fortune. That wouldn't have changed the outcome of what that doctor told my dad that day.
I would say, I would imagine the prolonged grief that he was experiencing after the loss of your nan would have made a huge factor in that.
And also part
it
of
really
it
does.
As well, you know. And but even then, like I said, you can buy health, but you can buy insurance, but not health.
Health
insurance, but it doesn't guarantee you health.
Yeah.
You can buy a house, not a home. My home, for me, is when there are dirty trainers on the floor. There are toys everywhere. There is a laptop on with a telly on at the same time. That shows that kids live in your house.
Yeah.
That's a home. That is a home. What's the point of the home where don't sit on that? That costs a lot of money. Don't jump on that. Well, that's the point. Kids are going to do that. And that's the memories that you make. You know, when you sat on the plane with my son and my partner, my son in the pool in Turkey last year, when he went to Turkey, you know, he's got learning difficulties and he loves animals, and he's, you know, the stray cats, he's got pictures with the cats, and you can see my son's face, like he's remembering those holidays, you know, he's remembering he's having those memories. And I don't want to sound very cheesy or too soft, but I never had those, you know, really. So that's why I said I want to break the mold. I want that for myself. I want him to have very fond memories of his dad and his mum. I want him to have fond memories of his family. I want him to grow up when I'm finally gone. I want him, as a father, I want him to say, he was a good father. For me, that's mission accomplished. If my children say, "I'm a very good father," that for me, that's mission accomplished for me.
100%. Well, thank you, Wes. It's been great having you. And no doubt we'll have Wes on again. So for now, thank you for listening. And we'll see you on the next episode.
Thank you for having me. It's been great.
Thank you for tuning in and being part of this vital conversation. If you feel inspired to take action and support women, girls and children affected by abuse, please visit the show notes in Kate's bio on UK Health Radio. There you can register your interest in becoming a certified trauma-informed expert, specialising in topics that address this ever-growing crisis. Together, we can shape a safer future for those who need it most. Until next time, stay strong, stay informed, and remember, you are never alone.